From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. From time to time when he's talking to people, the farmer and poet Gary Nabhan will ask them to close their eyes and imagine a food they had as a child. If you're of a certain age, the memory could be of a carrot just pulled from the ground, or an apple in a bushel basket from a roadside stand. In a modern global economy where multinational agribusiness concerns can transport most any kind of food at any season, Nabhan worries these memories are being lost. Today in the program, we're beginning a series on the food of a season. We'll get started with soil, how you get it ready, but also how we're all connected to the ground beneath us. This is also about a new group of farmers coming onto the scene who use age-old technology and the wisdom from a fading generation to grow their own food. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. My parents always had some kind of garden when I was growing up. My mom had a legendary raspberry patch, and part of my chores on the weekend included weeding rows of carrots and radishes. And even today, though they're in their 80s, they still make an effort at tomatoes and cucumbers. And if any of their younger neighbors wanted to know when to get the peas in the ground or when to worry about frost, they'd just have to ask. This is what the writer and folklorist Gary Nabhan means when he talks about the cultural wisdom of a place. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations about the food of a season. We wanted to talk about peaches in the early fall, or the melons in summer, or the corn when it's just right. We're going to start today, though, with the idea itself of growing your own food, of what seems to be a new generation of people who are trying to revive the tradition of backyard gardens or full-on farms. We'll start with the soil itself today, how you get it ready, what you should be planting, or what you already should have in the ground. And we'd like to hear from you today. Those of you who have those memories of vegetables from the garden, or those who have returned to the land, what is the appeal of growing it for yourself? You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook or on Twitter as well. Fred Montag is joining us. He's a professor emeritus of biology at the University of Utah, the author of Gardening, an Ecological Approach. And he's here with us in the studio. And Fred Montag, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Gary Paul Nabhan is with us. He's a sustainable agriculture activist, a conservation biologist. Utney Reader magazine named him one of the 20 people making the world a better place in 2011. He's also the author of dozens of books, including his newest, Desert Terroir, exploring the unique flavors and sundry places of the borderlands. And Mr. Nabhan is joining us today from his farm in Patagonia, Arizona. And Gary Nabhan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with both of you on this spring day.
Well, I wanted to begin, Gary Nabhan, I wanted to start with you. It's a pretty broad question, forgive me, but how does a person, do you think, relate to the soil beneath them? You know, the minerals and elements beneath them. How do you describe, how do you explain that connection?
Well, producing food with the help of that soil is our most direct connection to the environment, to the world around us, to the planet. And yet, it's mediated by soil microbes and invertebrates, worms, et cetera, that we seldom see. And yet, getting down on your hands and knees and working in the soil, as I happen to do at 6 o'clock this morning, really builds my awareness throughout the day that we are all fed by this interaction with a range of organisms, the ecological approach that Fred has championed, and that we need that connection to remind us where our food comes from and how to make a place for that, not only in our culture, but in a world that's undergoing rapid change. Mm.
You've written a poem that I wanted to ask you about. I read this morning. It's a terroirist's manifesto for eating in place. And in it, you mentioned that we all can know where our food comes from, first of all, by the very way that it tastes. And you mentioned in the poem, you know, you can sense a hint of mint in the cheese, for example, which may suggest what the goat has eaten. Or you can sense, lime in the soil, in a glass of wine. Talk about what you mean, this idea that we can taste our place.
Well, this word terroir that the French use is really a concept that is not exclusively owned by the French. My Lebanese relatives in the Middle East tell me that the yogurt and cheese that they produce during the summer when their sheep are up in the mountain pastures of wild thyme tastes completely different than what is produced the rest of the year, because that's coming from a different soil and substrate. The same thing with my Navajo friends on the Utah-Arizona border, who say that they don't need to add any spices to their lamb or mutton stew because during the summer the sheep are eating so much sagebrush that it's naturally imbued with this herby flavor. So a lot of us aren't aware of that. Winemakers talk about it more than anyone else, perhaps, but it's really in all of our foods, and we just have to be alert to it.
So if, let's say I eat a tomato from my parents' garden. Can I discern it, or is there something unconscious going on that seems familiar? Do you know what I mean?
You know, we don't have a great vocabulary for describing it, but I don't think it's unconscious. Where I visit friends in New Orleans, they talk about Creole cream cheese and tomatoes from the Mississippi floodplain, and even the same variety of tomatoes grown on a different soil doesn't taste the same to them. And so they use this term Creole or Cajun tomatoes for a particular flavor, even though the botanical variety can be grown at another place in the South. It just doesn't have the same taste and texture. And so I don't think this is a completely unconscious thing. People blindfolded in Vermont can tell different kinds of maple syrup, some that's been grown on schist soils from that grown on shale soils. And they can do this with a high accuracy, even though they don't have the words to describe that. Our taste is precise.
Yeah. Fred Montag, I wanted to hear you on this. What do you think? Can you identify what it is that's familiar?
I can, and I think that I need to relate this to things that I did in the classroom with students, and that was to have them understand something about an ecological identity. If you ask a student, or if you ask anyone, to name five or six things that they are, if you just in general, without any qualifiers, they usually turn out to be very socially appropriate kinds of identities that they have: political parties, religions, a major at a university, and so forth.
Sure.
But what is missing in all of this, and that is, it's an ecological identity. Very few people say that they're primates. Very few people say that they're even mammals. And then if we get going even deeper than that, I ask students how old they are. And, of course, they whip out their driver's license, and that would be that date plus 9 months perhaps. But I would argue that they're probably 4.7 billion years old. And what that means is, and this is, I mean, this is pure science. There's no question about this, is that every atom in your body was not created the day you were born. That you are made out of earth materials, and you constantly take materials into your body, and you constantly get materials back. And so in that sense, you are the environment with a conscience, or a spirit, or a soul, however you define those kinds of things, which I'm less an expert about. Okay, but in terms of the materials, the elements that make up your body, those things have been here as long as the earth has been here. And so this gives us not only an intellectual connection to the land, it gives us a direct life-promoting connection to land. Without that constant flow of materials, if you stop the flow of materials into and out of your body, that's called death.
Right.
And so we are the environment, and the way that we manifest ourselves in that way is a genetically programmed arrangement of atoms and molecules that process energy and materials. And so if students can do that, then the imagination in the story becomes even greater, because people start saying, well, what if my elements and molecules had memories? Think of all the things that we have been in our past, because we're made up of these things. The other thing that makes totally logical sense for even the most ardent anti-environmentalist would be that since you're made up of environment, wouldn't you want the environment to be as ecologically and evolutionarily appropriate as possible, which generally means clean air, clean water, nutritious food, organic food, and so forth. So that's a way to get people back to Earth in just one example, I think.
Have we, Gary Paul Nabhan, have we ever... I'm guessing Fred Montag students may look at you a little bit confused at first when you work through that, right? And I'm wondering if there was ever a time when that made more sense to us culturally, that, oh, yeah, we're a part of the soil. Has it ever been a part of who we are?
Well, that's what the word Adam means, Adama. The Hebrew word means that we are from the soil. And I would claim that the idea that we're each this isolated individual is a relatively recent concept in Western civilization, and that most people who've lived on Earth up until the 20th century didn't even carry that notion in their heads. I mean, after all, we're not really individuals. Each of us, when we say that's my body, is really talking a body that isn't just our genome, but there's 10 to the 6 more cells of other organisms in and on us than our own, the cells of our own genome. And so we're all wildlife communities, and when we go out and get a soil under our fingernails, as I did this morning while I was working in my orchard, we're really renewing that flow of molecules and genes from other organisms that are actually part of our health. We couldn't exist without those microbes in our stomachs and throats and nostrils and ears. So it's... they're with us whether we garden or not,
right.
And connecting to them through the acts of growing food and fermenting food reminds us of these connections.
Fred Montag, you've said that we have a food bubble right now that is likely to burst. Give us a sense of what you're talking about. This is something
we
worry about.
We have several bubbles, and it's a complicated interrelationship between everybody knows what a housing bubble is and what a financial bubble is, but a food bubble is where we are kind of coasting on the accumulated biological capital of the past 10,000 years in terms of soil and in terms of fossil water or water in aquifers and so forth. And so we have abundant food right now. We have food probably in just in terms of gross calories to be able to feed the 7 billion people on the planet. By 2050, though, we're going to add 2.6 billion more people. And I would argue with lots of agriculturalists and ecologists probably that we're really pushing things right now in terms of our ability to produce food in the future. Part of the problem is that we're degrading land as we produce food. As we degrade land, we abandon it, and then we keep clearing forests and grasslands. And so this is the biodiversity link with expanding agriculture. But the food bubble is food now being produced artificially with fertilizer, which is a way to is to take a whip to a horse to get another mile out of it instead of resting the horse and feeding the horse and getting a lifetime of use out of it. And so while soil is a renewable resource, we're currently losing soil faster than it can be formed. Estimates are 25 billion tons down the world's rivers annually in excess of soil formation. Now, for those who don't believe that, and taking organic matter and nitrogen fertilizer with it, for people who don't believe that, then that they need to Google hypoxic zone in the world's oceans, and there are more than 300 or so of these hypoxic zones that are where all this accumulated fertility is actually creating havoc in terms of near marine coastal marine ecosystems. And then the other bubble that everybody's talking about today, but nobody makes the connections, is the fossil fuel bubble, especially petroleum.
Yeah.
And there's no politician that's in charge of the price of petroleum, even though that's what we hear constantly on talk radio, including NPR. And it is speculators who have a good sense of how much petroleum there really is. And so since agriculture is the kind of intensive agriculture that we have that is now feeding the world is based on significant fossil fuel inputs in the form of nitrogen fertilizer from natural gas, in terms of pesticides from petroleum, in terms of diesel fuel and transportation of food and so forth, I really do believe it is a food bubble. And my story is that as a wildlife biologist, it finally occurred to me at age 48, I've now made 67 trips around the sun, but at age 48, it occurred to me that we have more wildlife biologists on the planet than we've ever had in human history. And yet wild things have never been so endangered, generally. And so what was wrong with that picture?
Yeah.
And so in that case, lots of wildlife biologists at universities began teaching environmental science courses. And then we try to do things that really make a difference. And my sense is that it's going to be sort of the ultimate admission of failure of the human enterprise if we have to plow up the last wild place in order to grow food for people. And so now the logical thing says we need to grow food where we live.
Yeah.
And just as an example, the thing that struck me the most was a campus which is relatively level, relatively fertile, very well watered, and with lots of, as Wes Jackson would say, lots of eyes per acre, lots of caretakers standing around waiting to be asked to do something noble.
Yeah.
And so the garden turns out to be this reconnection to these basic functions in ecology, which would be perpetual solar energy and nutrient cycling, which is what we've been talking about.
That's great.
So, Gary Paul Nabhan, how did we lose? So, if there was a generational connection before, like my folks, for example. What happened to the baby boomers? I mean, how did we lose it? It seems like, and I'm wondering if this is accurate, that we lost that connection in the course of just one generation or something like that.
Well, we went from a majority of people engaged in their own food production almost a century ago to less than 1.5% of Americans self-identifying as farmers today.
Yeah.
And I want to bring this home to the Southwest, too. We thought that land was limitless and water was limitless. But in the Sun Belt here, Utah, Arizona, Nevada, California to Texas along the border, 1/4 of the entire U.S. farmland loss since 1985 has been in the Sun Belt. So we had one of the largest mass exoduses from temperate regions in world histories to an arid region, and then took all the water that was originally brought in behind dams and reservoirs to grow food and built on that land. And most people in the greater Southwest now feel that food will come in from some other place, and we really don't need to worry about keeping arable land intact for food production and our own food security in the future. So now 60% of the fresh produce that we eat in the winter months comes in from Mexico. We've outsourced that to Mexico at great cost to our own economy and to theirs. And yet that's going to change again. By 2018, according to Forbes magazine, probably 1 in every 5 meals or salads and vegetables you eat, especially the fresh produce, is going to come from rooftops and parking lots that are converted to food production. And I'm already seeing this happening. In Seattle, they're growing mushrooms on coffee grounds, something that they have in great abundance. In L.A., they're paying $150,000 an acre to reclaim places that used to be gas stations where they were dripping oil and gasoline into the soil. They're cleaning that up, and it's more valuable to produce food on that lot than to produce services.
Yeah.
So we're in this cusp in time where things are going to change very rapidly now, back in the direction that we once lived. But there's going to be far less resources, especially fossil fuel and fossil water, to engage in that production. So we're going to have to use our ecological intelligence and really understand what's possible in each kind of ecosystem if this is at all to be sustainable.
But I guess the question is, why are people returning to the idea? Why are we starting to see people breaking up parking lots and, you know, planting peas? And what's the – because something went right.
The health costs of having cheap but poor food of poor nutritional value is one of the most enormous health costs and social costs we have in this country. So I live in a place along the border where there's a diabetes epidemic. 60% of the adults in the counties next to me suffer from adult onset diabetes. That's the major factor debilitating them, that they've eaten poor food instead of nutritionally dense food most of their lives, got little exercise, and they're being told, raise a garden, eat fresh food, get more exercise. And so something that was once a luxury over the last half of the 20th century, oh, have a little garden, have a little orchard, grow some of your food, is now a necessity to most of these people. And I have to say the Mormon communities of Utah are one of the few places where a food production and storage ethic has persisted in North America. I think the rural communities of southern Utah still have that ethic that many Americans are trying to regain.
Mm. Fred Montag.
let me address two points, important points that Gary brought up. One, plowing up parking lots and so forth. At one of my public lectures, I had an official from the Utah Department of Agriculture email me later saying, what can we do about cropland loss to urban sprawl? And it dawned on me after I gave it a little bit of thought that farmland that has houses on it is still farmland. It just has more people now. And so this was, in terms of my approach to things, this turned out to be sort of the right answer, was that we just have caretakers now on more and more land. In terms of the health consequences of modern industrial food, processed food, low nutrient, lots of anti-nutrients added, I don't think that people are stupid, and I think that they have a sense that there is a relationship. And here's one of the richest nations in the world, that we have. We have these issues. We have environment and lifestyle issues affecting a different kind of disease than in less developed countries, and that the very best national health insurance program on the planet is simply good health. And so if you understand what made us what we are as thinking in cooperative generally and communicating intelligent primates. Mm-hmm. It has been 200,000 years of eating whole, wild, organic food. When I push organic food, this is not a new age fad. This is what our bodies are adapted to be using. The aberration is the industrial food since World War II. Mentioned or asked a moment ago what got us away from that agrarian tradition, yeah, which, you know, Jefferson and now Wendell Berry and Gary and other people talk about, I tell students that the world went down this wrong path. I usually use stronger words than that. But on the day that I was born after World War II, as we converted all of this industrial wartime capacity into agriculture. So we took tanks and heavy trucks. We made tractors and combines. We took chemical weapons and we made pesticides. We took gunpowder and now we have nitrogen fertilizer. And, of course, we did the same kind of attack on marine fisheries with naval technology. But that, in addition to the corporate decisions to create throwaway consumption in an effort to liberate – now, listen to this – in an effort to liberate people from the drudgery of growing their own food. In other words, in order to liberate people from the drudgery of being moderately competent. It's a perfect business plan if you really stop and think about it. But it's not sustainable. And now we have 18% of the world's population on this track, whereas – and then the other 82% of humanity – which is going to account for most of this 2.6 billion increase, aspiring to the same kind of thing. They're aspiring to a promise that can't be fulfilled, I think.
Fred Montag is with us, professor emeritus of biology at the University of Utah, author of Gardening, an Ecological Approach. Gary Paul Nabhan is with us, a sustainable agricultural activist and author of a lot of books. His latest is Desert Terroir, Exploring the Unique Flavors and Sundry Places of the Borderlands. We are late for a break. We can invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We are starting a series on the program today. We wanted to profile food in its season, like a peach in early fall or a tomato in the heat of summer. It's about the revival of this idea of growing your own food, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Fred Montag is with us. We also have Gary Paul Nabhan. Let me introduce another couple of voices here into the conversation. Lindsay Lusher-Shoot is joining us, director of the National Young Farmers Coalition, joining us from her farm in New York's Hudson Valley. And Lindsay Lusher-Shoot, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Celia Bell is with us, an urban homesteader here in Salt Lake City. Celia, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Sharon Leopardi is founder of Bug Farms. It's an urban farm in CSA, also in Salt Lake City. Sharon, welcome to you.
So glad to be here.
Thanks for being with us. I wanted to start, I guess the question I wanted to have for you, and Lindsay, let me put this to you first, is
who
is the young farmer? Like, do they fit a particular type? Who are you guys?
Well, we are the National Young Farmers Coalition, and we are a group of young farmers that are networked all across the country that are trying to grow food and are facing tremendous barriers in getting started in farming careers, which is why we came together. And the profile of at least the farmers that are identifying with what we're doing as an organization are actually oftentimes coming to farming from a non-farming background. So they may, like myself, my parents weren't farmers. I grew up in right outside of Columbus, Ohio, but my great-grandparents, farmed hogs and had an apple orchard. Mm-hmm. So it's people who have farming in their blood but haven't been farming for some time and are really motivated to get into farming because of all of the work that's been happening within the good food movement. It's people who want to, get out onto the land, have an active career, and really be able to enhance the health of their communities and, have a very independent and rewarding career.
So Sharon Leopardi, let me ask you, you've been doing this how long now?
This will be my third year.
Third year, so yeah. Pretty new, right?
Yeah, pretty new.
So what is it, What drew you to it? Like, what was the idea or the philosophy that you found so appealing about the concept?
Gosh, I mean, there's so many reasons why I did it, and that's probably the only reason that I'm sticking with it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, taking classes from Fred and learning how growing food is one of the most radical ways of, like, affecting our system. And also I was always loved being outside and connecting with place, like, and in really subtle and daily ways.
Yeah.
And so that really inspired me and keeps me going with it.
Yeah.
So
you started with a kind of a philosophy. There's an idea here that got you started, right? Okay, that's great. But then, and Lindsay will work toward the obstacles where it gets really hard and people ditch out sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But first, like, Celia, you've been doing this for like 15 years now.
14 years.
14 years now. So you get that it's hard, right?
Yeah.
But you still do it. Talk about when you started, you were probably a lot like Sharon, right? Super excited about it, wanted to make a difference. Are you different now in the way you look at it today?
I'm probably could come across as a little jaded. And I've farmed in a lot of different settings. So I lived on a 6-acre farm in southern Missouri and grew food for 90 people, or now I just grow food for my husband and I on a 1/2 acre in town. So that has evolved just depending on how much I felt like I could take on and how to balance being a part of this society and doing fun things like taking the dogs out on walks versus not leaving my yard for longer than 8-hour stints because I need to milk the goat.
Right. So you mentioned jaded. And Lindsay, I'm guessing this is the thing that concerns you, this idea that farmers who are excited about the prospect, they run into certain obstacles, I guess. That's one thing that you're worried about, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a bit of a reality check, you know, from if you're living in the city and you're thinking, oh, wow, wouldn't it be great to be out on a farm right now, you know, when I'm sitting here working at my computer doing farm work. It sounds very romantic. And then, when people actually get out on the land and do an apprenticeship or start working on a farm, you know, there's physical labor in farming that is exhausting. People get injured. I mean, it's a tough career in that way. But really the things that we find that farmers are really struggling with, and this is something that we've struggled with on our farm, is, you know, finding permanent access to land to farm and getting the capital together to start a farm business, or trying to farm, you know, if you have student loans or can't afford health insurance, these types of things. So people who have decided, you know, that this is a career for them, they like the work, they like, you know, milking goats or cows or whatever it might be, they still can't do it because of how, you know, zoning is structured, how the cost of farmland and the inability in many cases of folks to get loans or to raise the capital to start a farm business. Mm-hmm. We did a survey of farmers across the United States last year, and about 1,000 young and beginning farmers, primarily ages, you know, 25 to 35, responded. And, you know, the two biggest needs that came out of that survey, number one was capital, and number two was land access.
So, Sharon, do you know what you're up against? You keep hearing all of these things, the concerns and stuff like that. I mean, how do you measure all of that?
I totally relate to the challenges. Like, really, at this point, the farming part, the actually getting out and doing the labor, is the easy part,
yeah.
Like, for sure. Since I don't own any of the land that I use, it's really interesting dealing with other people's property and the ideas of, like, wanting to increase soil fertility and establish a space, but then the landowner might be really into using their land to, like, build a garage or something the next year. You know, that's really tricky. and also like drumming up enough CSA members every season and getting myself out there. Like the business aspect of it has definitely been the biggest challenge and like the biggest anxiety producer. Like my employees, I love being able to get outside. It's like my employees tend to do that more than I do. Yeah. Even these days, like I'm like calling people or connecting with chefs or whatever, trying to like make this a business that pays for us.
But the weeding and the getting your hands in the, that's the easy stuff.
That's the easy part sure. Like it was the hard part the first year, but I had to do it all together. But like we're getting our systems like on the farm down.
Yeah.
It's just keeping us financially sustainable. That's the really the kicker for sure.
So Celia Bell, I can go to Costco and get a clamshell full of like really beautiful strawberries. At least they look nice, right? what do you do? What do you see when you go to Costco and see these, you know, all of this food produced somewhere else? And it looks pretty good, I guess. I mean, what do you make of that?
I've wept in Costco before, seeing all of the produce that's there, and all you have to do is pay money rather than sweat and labor and preserve and all of that. It's pretty amazing, but something has given. Something has to give for that. Something has
There's a cost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For that. And you don't see that while you're at the grocery store. But I definitely, before starting this and growing my own food, I think I put down grocery store food more than I do now. Now I see more of what it took to get it there too, and have an appreciation for that. But my strawberries are definitely a lot tastier than those ones that you're going to get at Costco for sure.
So it's still worth it right now.
Oh yeah. You. Yeah. I would never, my husband and I, we eat probably at least a pound of salad each a day. And we would never do that buying it at the grocery store. We would, and it wouldn't taste as good. I mean, it's amazing to just right before my husband comes home from working his job that helps pay the mortgage to pay for the land. I go out and can harvest all the herbs in the yard, chop them up real fine, make this amazing salad that keeps us inspired and healthy to keep wanting to do it.
Yeah. So, Gary, Paul Knapan has to leave us here in a moment, so I wanted to come to you before we head to a break. Gary, Paul Knapan, the idea of finding a balance, I guess. Would you say something about that?
I teach sustainable ag at the University of Arizona, 45 miles from where I farm 3 acres of fruits and another 20 miles from where I farm heritage grains. And it's always a balance. I feel that every gardener is an educator. We need to be talking to people about what we do and why we do it, but not all of us have the luxury to be able to be full-time food producers. And yet I come back to something that I think you started this whole show with. Why do we do it? Because it's mentally and physically exhausting sometimes. And I come back to that old poem that Dr. William Carlos Williams did years ago. It's difficult to get the news from poems, but people die for the lack of that in their lives every day. And the same is true with this connection to the earth and our food. People are literally dying for lack of this connection with where their food comes from and the fresh produce that can not only sustain them nutritionally, but spiritually. And I think we're in the midst of a turning point in history where we need to make that connection again, or we'll lose the best of humanity and the best of our landscapes. So I'm really excited by this young farmers movement. I think it's a major revolution happening on the planet right now, and I'm grateful to hear Lindsay talk about her commitment. I just think it's the most wonderful thing going on in America right now.
It's Gary Paul Knapphan. Gary Paul Knapphan, thanks very much for the time.
Best to all of you.
Lindsay Lesher-Shute is with us, Celia Bell, Sharon Leopardi, and we'll have Fred Montag back with us also when we get back from a break. And we'll get to your calls, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're starting off a series where we wanted to talk about and profile food in its season, really talking about the revival of this idea of growing your own food. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to the phones. Lucas has been waiting in Ogden. Lucas, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting show today. It touches on a lot of things, I guess, that I've been going through and experiencing over the last couple of years. I saw, about 2 years ago, I saw that documentary called Fathead. It was kind of in response to that Super Size Me documentary.
Yeah.
Well, it got into a lot of the industrial agriculture and a lot of the companies that grow the food we eat and is in all the, you know, especially corn, but it's in all the products you go to the store and buy. And that actually really scared me when I saw that, and I saw all the chemicals and genetically modified everything that goes into our food. And so I started investigating, and I ended up getting into square foot gardening. And I am probably about as urban as it can get. I have a nice little suburban house, and I, you know, kept my lawn. That was about as much gardening or farming as I've ever done. But it was interesting, and I was joking with the screener about this, is me and my neighbors, you know, upper middle class, we have these exquisite, well-manicured lawns that everyone seems to care so much about. But if we took some of that energy and invested it into our gardens, how much better off we as a society would be if people were competing for, you know, who had the best tomato plants, is what the screener joked. And I thought that was pretty funny because I hadn't really thought about it like that. But how much land do we waste just growing lawns and when we could actually be doing something productive with it?
Lucas, glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Fred Montag, you want to say something about that? I mean, this idea of, is that where it starts? People sort of starting,
yes,
in small ways?
That is where it starts. Lucas is the model person, because everybody can do it. Not everybody can make a living at it.
Yeah.
But everyone can take some responsibility for their own food. And I think that the more they do it, and when they have success at it, it begins to expand. And we get back to that pre-World War II tradition where we have relatively more self-sufficient and livable neighborhoods when that happens.
Lindsay Lesher-Shute, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that we talked about earlier was your concerns for people who are just starting into this and what kind of obstacles they confront. What are the lessons we've learned from the past that you were applying to the people you talk to today?
Lessons learned from the past in terms of overcoming obstacles,
yeah,
in farming?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question, because I feel like there are so many the things that are really getting in the way of farming today. So many of the challenges are new challenges, like, you know, the issue of suburban development and sprawl and the cost of farmland. I would say, though, within the young farmers movement, one thing that we are directly borrowing from the past, and, you know, people continue to say sort of what's new about the young farmers movement, and the thing is, like, not really a whole lot, other than the problems have changed slightly and the problems maybe are bigger. But what's the same is that farmers have been working together, collaborating, communicating, you know, since the beginning of farming, you know, through, you know, the Grange movement, through the Farm Bureau, through many other institutions where farmers have realized that by cooperation they can do so much more together. And, you know, farming, you know, is all about where you are, all about your region, all about your town. You know, here in the Hudson Valley where I live, we the Young Farmers Coalition has regional coalitions that are affiliated with the national group, and we have one here in the Hudson Valley. And farmers get together on a regional, on a regular basis, and they share a meal, and then they talk about how they can work together. And some of that is on policy, and some of that is on simple things like, you know, where can my ram spend the rest of the summer, or how can we buy, you know, one big point of interest here is buying grain that is not genetically modified. And so now we are all working together to buy cooperatively grain, truckloads of grain from organic producers in Ohio and bringing it to the Hudson Valley to feed our hogs and chickens. So, you know, there are elements in what's happening today that are very much the same as what's been happening in farmer organizing, farmers, you know, trying to farm better, you know, for the last 100 years.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Julie is with us in Salt Lake. Julie, hi.
Hi there. I am the Urban Farming Program Coordinator for Salt Lake County, and I think this conversation is so timely. I'm actually speaking with the Council of Governments tomorrow about urban farming, and the Council of Governments is made up of all of the mayors in Salt Lake County, so the mayor of Sandy, Taylorsville, Salt Lake City, et cetera, and hope to find a way to enlighten and inspire them to see how they can be a part of this movement, whether it's modifying zoning or supporting the placement of conservation easements to permanently protect land. I think local government has to rethink scale. Farming in an urban environment does not look the way it used to look. And how can we integrate that into our plans for what our cities and our counties are going to look like?
Are people responding? I mean, what are you hearing from leaders? Do they get it yet?
Oh, yeah. They put me on the agenda. They're very interested in what we're doing.
They put you on the agenda. You got that.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, and also on a smaller scale, I mean, there are 35 community gardens now across the Salt Lake County Valley. And those are the ones that we know about that want to participate in. We actually have a community garden locator map on our urban farming website. So if somebody lives in Murray or lives in Salt Lake City or Sandy, they can go to that website, see where there is a community garden, see who they can contact to see if there's a room available.
Yeah. Well, we'll put a link, by the way, on our website, too.
Thank you.
Julie, good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Tanya's with us in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Tanya.
Hello. I, first of all, just have to say I'm totally dig this movement, and I love it. And my husband and I actually grow vegetables in our backyard. I'm a city girl, so ordinarily I wouldn't be commenting on this topic except for the fact that my father-in-law is a farmer.
Yeah.
And they have lots of land here in Texas, and they do quite a bit of farming. And it's not as, you know, it's not as romanticized as, it shouldn't be as romanticized as it is. You know, they really do suffer a lot, especially here in Texas with the droughts and stuff recently. And, you know, like anybody, it's a business, and it's the cost of it is very, very expensive, and they have to make a living. And, you know, my father-in-law, he even has a backyard garden for himself and his wife. So, you know, a lot of farmers are very respectful of the movement, and but this is their livelihood. They've been doing it for generations, and they need to live too.
Yeah.
So, but I'm all for the movement, and I think that it's wonderful that people are doing it.
Right. Well, Tanya, we're glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And she raises a question I wanted to put to all of you. Do you recommend this to everybody? I mean, who can handle it? Sharon, what do you – you know, it's hard,
yeah,
right? I mean,
it's for sure. It's hard. Someone who might be really motivated and by values probably and is fine with hard work and doing a lot of different things. You just have to be prepared for it to take
over.
The work and for it to take over your whole life,
yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah.
At least for a little while. And then you figure out ways to make it easier so it's not so much.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of flexibility not to say that I have these things, but I'm working on them, but flexibility and humility and creativity to like actually make it work and like being willing to stick through it, through it all. It's hard.
But. Celia, someone who's been jaded a little bit by it all, how do you respond to that question?
I think that everyone should get their hands dirty at what scale that is. Maybe it's microgreens in your windowsill. I work with women that are homeless and detoxing, and they need that fresh burst of energy of that the freshest food they can get.
Yeah.
I have friends that are – they don't garden because they dumpster dive or whatever, but I even suggest to them to grow maybe just some fresh herbs in their yard because you need that fresh nutrients too. So to try and make a living at it, like the caller said, even the people that have been farming for a really long time struggle, and a lot of them also have off-farm work too.
So it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So have a backup plan.
Yeah. Plan B. Fred, what do you think?
I think that aside from people who are trying to make a commercial success of the gardening, I think that we need to address for many of the current challenges that we face, we need to encourage everyone to grow a garden, whether it's for profit or not. The profit comes in better health. The profit comes in getting children educated about joyful work. It's not hard work, but it's joyful work. And responsibility. And one of the things that's missing maybe from this conversation is that you need to learn how to cook.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to grow food, now cooking is an art and a craft, and there's some science to it also. But this food, if I link back to this ecological identity thing, this food is a sacrament. I mean, literally, it is a sacrament. Something dies that you might live. And so to get people just into that realization that they are linked to the earth in that way. The sunbeams and the soil, as difficult as it may seem for commercial operations, for home gardeners, it's fairly straightforward. Plants want to grow, compost wants to happen, and we want to eat.
Yeah.
So,
Fred Montag, thank you very much for being with us. And Lindsay Lushershute, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Absolutely.
And Celia Bell and Sharon Leopardi, thank you both. And good luck. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.